Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season with a program titled Dreams and Revolutions tomorrow evening at the Performing Arts Center. The dreams come from the dreamy quality of a revolutionary piece by Claude Debussy. Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun is a composition that would set the table for the tonal revolutions of the 20th century. The other revolution is Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 11, which musically depicts the Russian Revolution of 1905. Or does it? We'll put that question to Tulsa Symphony Orchestra principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie, who will lead the orchestra in those works, as well as the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with the principal clarinetist David Carter as soloist. He joins me today to talk about this program of contrast here on Studio Tulsa. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
And you're getting the second half of the symphony's season underway with a really interesting program, and probably the most interesting for the average audience members. You're going to hear three pieces that are utterly different from one another.
Yes, lots of variety on this program. I mean, the very first work is Claude Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, which is a 10-minute work. Some people call it a tone poem because it's descriptive, and it's also based on literature. It was informed or inspired by literature. The same poem is titled by Stefan Mallarmé, the symbolist poet. But it isn't really depicting anything as much as it is just expressing the sentiment that's in the poem. And then second on the program, we have Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, which was his last fully instrumental work he wrote before he died. So this is the very mature Mozart at the old age of 35. And then we end the program with Shostakovich's 11th Symphony, which is a revolutionary type of work, astonishing in its scope and power and what he brings forward. So it's a lot of contrasts, wonderful and different colors and orchestral palettes and different aesthetics all the way through the program. So it's a real smorgasbord. And I think the pieces complement each other so well.
And it requires the orchestra to play in three distinct styles, too.
Yes, it does. It really does. Because the Debussy, of course, the French style really requires a real precision, but a perfect kind of collage of blends. And, of course, the Mozart is that classical style. And we have David Carter, who is our principal clarinetist with the Tulsa Symphony, who's playing the solo part. And it's a formidable solo part. It's very virtuosic, but also leaves lots of room for expression. And we already had a rehearsal with him. It's just going great. I mean, people are going to be knocked over with his playing. And then, of course, the Shostakovich, you leave the delicate playing behind a lot of times, and you really go for not coarseness necessarily, but to get into the spirit of the revolutionary style.
It's a direct piece.
It's very direct, very visceral in many, many respects. There are quiet and sublime moments, though, in it. I mean, Shostakovich, even within that symphony, creates lots of contrasts. But I remember even conductor Yuri Timurkhanov, who's the music director of the St. Petersburg Philharmonic, he would tell orchestras when they were playing certain Shostakovich works, not this particular one, but he'd say, it's too beautiful. You're playing it too beautifully. And so you want that beauty in the other works, and you do want it in parts of the Shostakovich 11. But there are other parts where if you're really trying to show the brutality of somewhat that music was about, it has to have an edge.
Now, all three of those different styles, is that a particular challenge for a conductor and an orchestra to do in a single evening?
Certainly it's a challenge, but the thing is the orchestra members are already on board with that. I mean, they're fully aware of these varying styles, and so they're very open to change, and they know that it needs to happen. And they're used to doing it now, I think, because just the way that a musician works these days, they have to go from playing jazz, you know, one moment and going to play classical or something more popular or chamber music or something. So they're used to, you know, stepping into these different worlds of performance. And so because at least the Debussy and the Mozart are pretty familiar, and at least the style of Shostakovich, I don't think it'll be too big of a challenge to make those changes, something that we'll work out in rehearsals.
But your average American symphony musician doesn't play the Shostakovich 11th very often.
That's true. That is not a commonplace symphony for Shostakovich's output. Certainly Shostakovich has played a fair amount. You know, you get the cello concerto, the violin concerto, piano concerto, sometimes one or two, and then a number of the symphonies, you know, one and five, 10. But yeah, 11 is not so common. This is an epic work, though, and there's so much in it. I mean, there's so much of a program that's in the music. And yet, I think the listener wouldn't have to know that because the music just kind of speaks for itself as well. And that's oftentimes what you how you can decide on the quality of a certain work. Does it require a program to prop it up for it to be of great quality? And I think in this case, people can kind of sit back and be mesmerized by it. But it does help to know a little bit of the background of what it's about.
Ostensibly, it's about the 1905 revolution in Russia, but that's up for debate too, whether it is really about the 1905 revolution. You have to remember, Shostakovich had been censured since the end of World War II. He was out of favor in the Soviet regime, and this symphony actually put him back into favor.
It's ironic in a sense. Because of what you said, because anyone who's done any reading about Shostakovich knows that he's not a straightforward figure in history to interpret. Because yes, he was censured and he was in trouble with the Stalinist regime, and he was made to, quote, confess to writing in Western formalistic styles and not enough of the Soviet socialist realism. But in this particular case, if you look at the fact that he wanted to write about the 1905 abortive revolution. I mean, this was just something that started, and it actually set a lot of events for the future kind of starting at that point. And of course, the eventual actual revolution that happened in October of 1917, so 12 years later, people started to put the pieces together a little bit when he said, you know, 1957, says, I want to write a symphony about the 1905 revolution to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the 1917 revolution. People were kind of scratching their heads saying, why is that? And this, you have to realize that also what was going on at this time was in 1956, there was a Hungarian uprising and the Soviet forces came in and it was a very brutal disaster, beating them down. And a lot of the Soviet people were appalled by that show of strength and power. And this was not lost on them, the timing of this work and talking about the brutality. Of course, when he said it's about the 1905 revolution, he's safe because you're talking about Tsarist Russia at that point and that the revolution is a good thing. And all the brutality that we hear, that's about the Tsars and about the Tsar's guards and what happened on that bloody Sunday of January 9th in 1905. But a lot of people thought that really what prompted him to write it was the Soviet oppression of the Hungarian uprising.
Yeah, and in fact, at some point, there's a bit of a dedication to the people who suffered in the revolution, and that could be interpreted as 1905 or 1956.
It could. And see, Shostakovich was able to, in a sense, hide or disguise what he's writing about by using purely instrumental forces because there is no text. When he wrote songs and operas, he got even in more trouble, or he would write for chorus and he was using a text that would actually say something. And obviously words are pretty powerful. But when you can write with just notes, there was a little more of a place to hide behind something. And he said, well, you can't prove that I'm writing it about what the Soviets did to the Hungarians. But even his son, Maxim, said to him at one point when he was hearing the music, he said, Dad, are they going to hang you for this? Because he could hear it. And I think a lot of Russian people did, which is why I said it was ironic that he actually won the Lenin Prize for the work.
And he fooled the Soviets. And he also fooled the West because for a number of years, the 11th was considered sort of a piece of agitprop, if you will, for glorifying the Russian Revolution, the one that would happen later.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And the thing is, you know, even though he didn't put actual words in, he did use songs. Revolutionary songs of the time. He incorporated them, I mean, just right into the symphony. You hear the melodies that are practically verbatim, and then he uses a lot of variation on those as well. He doesn't do it always verbatim. But he uses those revolutionary songs, and actually songs from the Tsarist time, too, 19th century, incorporated, kind of sprinkled throughout. And then he uses kind of the counterpoint of all of those themes coming in and overlapping with each other to make this kind of complex collage of sound.
And that's one of the things you hear when you hear this piece. At times, it doesn't sound as Shostakovich as you expect a Shostakovich symphony to sound like. And then all of a sudden, there'll be his counterpoint, which is that sort of bitter, mocking tone in his counterpoint that's always a part of nearly every one of his works.
Yeah. And you do sense that. I mean, he definitely, there are those Shostakovich moments, those kind of timbres and that he gets by putting in celeste with harmonics in the harp. and piccolo and certain percussion instruments and trills and harmonics in the strings. I mean, it sounds all so technical, but he's able to create this world where you step into it and it feels foreboding or scary or ominous or something like that. He also has these moments that are very bombastic and sound oppressive, but there are other moments that are quiet only when one solo instrument is playing. And he is able to create the sense of loneliness, I think, so strongly that anyone sitting there, you wouldn't have to know a thing about what the symphony is about, but you can relate to what is happening just because the music is telling you.
And when you hear this music, you begin to understand why film music today sounds the way it does. I think one critic, and I'm not sure if he meant this pejoratively or admiringly, but he said this was the Symphony No. 11 was a film score looking for a film.
Yeah, I think I saw that at some point. And, you know, there is a certain point to it. I mean, it definitely has a feel of a story, of telling a story. And he does put titles of the events in the score. I mean, it's in the music. So the first movement is the palace square. And this is where presumably the workers are all lining up. 1,000 workers are coming in to do a very peaceful protest and come to the czar to say, hey, you know, things are tough and we'd like to see if things can change a little bit for us. But it was very peaceful. That's by all accounts. And for some conspicuous reason, I mean, the czar was absent. He was not there. And there was some nervousness that happened. And the troops opened fire and just annihilated these workers. These were just innocent, defenseless people. And then we're now in the second movement, which is really about the massacre. And that is the most brutal kind of music there and incorporates more songs in that. And then we get to the third movement, which is about the fallen. Kind of a requiem.
It is, really.
And it's very, very sad. And Shostakovich even talks about this at one point. He said he saw a cart full of young boys that had been shot out of the trees. And they had no idea. They were smiling down at the soldiers, not knowing that they were about to be killed. And the soldiers just shot them out of the trees and piled them up on the cart. And Shostakovich said the boys still had smiles on their faces because they hadn't even realized what was about to happen to them. Now, of course, Shostakovich was not alive at this time, so he was told this story. Right. And he remembers, because he said that people talked about the 1905 revolution a lot. And so that's the third movement. And then there's the fourth movement. That's the tocsin, or the alarm bell, is sounding. And at the very end of the symphony, we actually hear an actual bell playing in the tonality of G major and G minor going back and forth, which then leaves what we've been talking about, what's this whole thing about, even more ambiguous at the very end.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that third movement, the Requiem movement you talked about. It has a beautiful melody in the lower strings.
Yes.
And I think it was Shostakovich himself said this was his most Mussorgskian sort of symphony, and this melody is a beautiful melody.
It's true.
Yeah, well, let's hear music from the Symphony No. 11 by Shostakovich.
Great.
That's music from the Symphony No. 11 by Dmitri Shostakovich, one of the featured works in the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's Dreams and Revolutions concert this Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. My guest is conductor for the evening, the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Heggie. And from the Shostakovich, in the first half, you're doing Debussy, another revolutionary piece in its own way, and it's more of a musical revolution. And you know, when you hear the descriptions, when you read descriptions of the Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, I think most people would say, wow, this is going to be really out there. And actually, by today's ears, it is just this beautiful, sumptuous score. but it did bend ears when it was first written.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree with you. At the time it was written, it was starting to really stretch tonality to its limits. This is right at the end of the 19th century. This is 1894 when it was premiered. And no one had really heard anything like that. I mean, from starting with the solo flute to the certain intervals that are used, whole tone scales, a kind of exoticism using kind of non-Western traditional ways of using harmony, the way he uses silence, the way he uses a sort of kind of stasis of where is it really leading in this, usually you have this phrase that goes to here and then it goes to here and there's a development. But what he does is kind of constant invention that he takes from the very first statement of the flute and builds everything from that, which is not that in and of itself is not such a revolutionary thing. But how he does it is he just keeps inventing things from almost like from bar to bar, like it's one evolution all the way through. And it kind of tells a story, but he does it more through just the feeling of the poem. And even with the symbolist poet, Stefan Mallarmé, with that symbolist kind of poetry, if you read it, it also almost has that kind of feeling. I mean, it isn't like it makes sense, like here's a logical thought I'm going to present, and then we're going to go to this logical thought. It's almost like these are euphonious sounds of words, and they go together nicely, and it's okay just for that purpose. And it's kind of like that with the Debussy as well. But I think if people are looking for something, yes, the sumptuous sound, the exotic quality, beautiful melodies, and different timbres and colors, the way the orchestra is used. So it's not overly dramatic, but if they know something about what the poem is about, this is about a faun or a fantasy creature of half faun, half man, waking up from an afternoon slumber, dreaming about these conquests with nymphs. You know, it's a very sensual kind of thing that is being conjured up. And I think Debussy succeeds so well in that, in the music.
And you mentioned timbre and color. This is, I assume that's your main challenge, is to bring out those timbres and colors and make sure everything's balanced so that you hear these very subtle changes in orchestration which create these sort of different sound palettes, if you will.
Yeah, it's true. It takes a real sense of being able to blend things with the right balance.
And is that what you're worried about textures in rehearsal?
Well, it's something that certainly needs someone to kind of say, okay, this is the voice that has to be heard more at this point, and this is the blend that we need at this particular place. This eighth note needs to come out more at this point, and these people have to be more subtle. Because Debussy, quite frankly, I mean, what a genius. But when he scored things, he did leave a lot to the performers to have to figure out, because he was not, if we can say a counterpart of Debussy, another composer, was Maurice Ravel. Ravel was like taking a scalpel and going in with a score and making sure in a very meticulous way that all the dynamics and every little thing was taken care of, so that if you just followed what Ravel did, everything was going to be fine. Not such the case with Debussy. He left a little more to risk, in a sense, by putting in certain dynamics that were, I mean, you could see what he wants, but it wouldn't work with those instrumental groups. So you're always working to say, okay, this is the voice within the orchestra that needs to be predominant at this moment, and go from there.
And to the point of this eighth note.
Yes. Well, I'm telling you, for a conductor and for the orchestra, I mean, you really have to know what's going on in every eighth note in it. It doesn't just kind of go on its own. You really had to have special attention about how every little thing is going to unfold.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little music from the prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, and we're going to pick it up about midway through.
Uh-huh.
This is that beautiful counter melody, if you will, in the strings. Everybody knows the
gorgeous,
beautiful opening flute solo, and
yes,
that puts the fear in flutes everywhere.
Yeah, it's a big flute solo.
Yeah, but here is that counter theme from Claude Debussy, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening.
Thank you.
It's music by Claude Debussy, part of a program for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra titled Dreams and Revolutions this Saturday. And the final piece features principal clarinetist David Carter, who's a wonderful player.
Oh,
and he's
fantastic.
Often featured with the orchestra. I mean, he's done a lot of different things. But this clarinet concerto is really a special piece.
It really is. I mean, it's really one of the real pinnacles in their repertoire to play with the orchestra. And it's just such a sublime work, and it's just so perfectly composed. And we can say this about so much of Mozart. And out of his enormous output, which is of such high quality, of Mozart's output, to say this is really one of the great concertos, great purely instrumental works, even with all of his works, is saying a lot. It's very traditional in certain ways. It has the three movements that we come to expect from the classical concerto. It has an orchestral exposition before the clarinet comes in. But it's really, you know, it's a large concerto. It's a weighty concerto. A lot of times when people say, oh, Mozart, yes, you know, like this little piece of Mozart. But it's like, no, this is a real work. You know, it's about 30 minutes long, which that may not sound long to a listener, but a concerto, it's a substantial work. And I tell you that we've been talking about contrast and variety within the program, but even within this concerto, you know, you have the very substantial first movement, and then you have the quiet, slow kind of aria in the second movement. And in the third movement, you have this very jaunty kind of scherzo, almost humorous last movement, which is very light. And David, I've already been working with him a little bit. He's doing a little bit of improvisation here and there when something is repeated, when there's a repeated passage, which is a classical practice. Composers expected people to do this. When you repeat the phrase after it's written verbatim, if it's written verbatim again, the soloist has a little bit of freedom to do something a little bit different.
Now, have you ever experienced that with a soloist like that
before? I have, especially in classical pieces. I know I worked with David Zinman, who has done these great recordings of the Beethoven symphonies, and he even has wind players do some of those things in the symphony. When they have a repeated phrase, they'll play it the way it's written, and then they'll do a slight bit of ornamentation on it the second time. So this is kind of a classical music.
We have to remember how these were written. These were written for parties and occasions, and it was, here's the band, let's play it.
Well, sure, and think about it. You know, the idea of the cadenza, for example, and there's not actually a written out formal cadenza in this particular work of the clarinet concerto, but oftentimes for the piano concertos, the violin concertos, the player was expected to be able to come up with one, not necessarily on the spot, but they were expected to have written a cadenza for it. So there was a lot given to the performer in terms of adding things.
Now, when you say he's going to improvise, is it more of a matter of ornamentation?
Yeah, it's more like just ornamentation.
Ornamentation.
Yeah, he's not going to go off for like 16 bars and do something. We'll just do some walking bass or something, but... You know, well, at this point, I'll have to see if he's changed his mind about that. We'll see in the concert. That's always the magic of the moment. No, he's not going to do that. It's just like slight ornamentation or maybe playing some, notes just before or something, going between the intervals or something. Nope. I don't know if people would even be that aware of that.
We've talked about how this program is a program of contrast. Actually, within the three movements of this concerto, you have the sort of three Mozarts, if you will, that very playful sense of humor in the finale, the sort of refined. The first movement it's a traditional sonata allegro form, but it has this wonderful refined sense to it. And then you have this beautiful slow melody in the second movement in the adagio that is just gorgeous.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, you have a very, very active textures in the first and last movements. And like you said, the first movement is always where the composer shows the kind of compositional metal, if you will, about composing the form. So the proportions of the first movement are just so stately and elegant and very fast, technically challenging. Slow movement is like this beautiful aria. It's just very quiet, so inward, as opposed to the first movement, which was so out and more of a proclamation. And then you get to the last movement, which is jaunty and humorous, like, oh, yes, I know that was a kind of serious second movement, but let's not take ourselves too seriously, is almost like what Mozart is saying by jumping headlong into this dance-like music.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that dance from the final movement of the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. Thank you. That's a portion of the final movement of the Rondo from the Clarinet Concerto by Mozart, one of three works to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, in this case with principal clarinetist David Carter. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. This is your second concert of the year. Are you coming back? Are you coming back one more time this year?
Yes, coming one more time in May for the final concert of the season.
Yeah, and how's this working out? I mean,
it's working great.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's enjoyable to come back and work with the orchestra a little bit more often than I used to. We can start at a certain point of departure, which is a little bit more advanced, I think, just because we know each other a little bit. They know my language, my conducting language, and the things that are important to me. I know what's important to them, and I feel like it's a very nice partnership. You know, when you spend time around another person, after a while, when you start to think you can finish their sentences for them a little bit, then it's not quite like that, but something like that, where you can develop this kind of symbiotic relationship.
Well, I suppose things are going well with your main orchestra in Wichita as well.
Yes, and very well.
Any big things coming up for you down the road?
Shostakovich 11th. They're always, everything's, you know, a big project. It seems like I'm doing a huge Gershwin program with Wichita in a couple of weeks, and then symphonic dances of Rachmaninoff a little bit later, Verdi Requiem with them. So there's always something big on the horizon. It's always... Oh, you know, you get done with one program and you're right off to the next thing. So that's how it is for me.
Now, in Wichita, are you conducting most of the programs
there?
Yes. And, you know, and one of the things that's nice about the TSO is the fact that they are seeing a variety of conductors like a larger orchestra does. You know, they see a whole bunch of conductors for good or ill.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, that oftentimes is a benefit to the orchestra to see a variety of conductors.
It is.
Is it also good for the conductor to, you know, who's working with one orchestra all the time to come away and just have a different orchestra in front of them for a change?
Oh, absolutely. It's always good to be kind of sharing information and have people go from one place to another. It's good for the conductor to go conduct other orchestras. You always learn something new in a very beneficial way by going to conduct another orchestra. And the orchestras hopefully then also benefit from having other ideas from another conductor coming in and listening to them and working with them.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success with this program this weekend.
Thank you.
Saturday evening. Daniel Heggie, thanks very much
for
joining us again.
Yeah, great to be here.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, who will lead the orchestra in Dreams and Revolutions, a program tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. For information, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with more music from the Shostakovich Symphony No. 11 here on Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.